Welcome everybody, and thanks for being here. It's our seventh tutorial for the Awakened World 2012 Engaged Spirituality for the 21st Century. It's just a little over a month before we'll be meeting each other face-to-face in Rome. And having done these tutorials, I think we're getting a lot of feedback from people that people are feeling more engaged in the conference and more familiar with the issues, feeling a sense of presence and excitement. I can certainly tell you that it's busy around here, and I'm talking to a lot of people, and we're putting the finishing touches on everything from the program to logistics to working with core group members and facilitators. So there's been a tremendous amount of effort put in by all of us, including those of you who have been doing the tutorials and joining us on the calls and joining us on Italian lessons. And I think that all of this collective effort is really going to show up as very worthwhile by the time we get there. We will have already built a community and prepared ourselves for this really exciting event. I wanted to say a greeting to my co-director, Jim Kenny, who's driven 400 miles today and is someplace in Nebraska and settled down to be on the call today. Hi, Jim. How are you doing?
Hey, just fine. Just fine.
Good. And Reverend Dr. Donna Burns is here with us. Hi, Donna.
Hi, Barbara. Hi, everyone.
And our good old engineer, Megan Stanek, who's AT&T's assistant, here in Santa Barbara, California. So we're all ready to proceed today. The religious tradition, spiritual tradition under exploration today, our indigenous traditions, specifically Native American tradition, and the overall topic is nature and ecofeminism. As many of you know, if you've listened to the pre-recordings, they were done on our tutorial by Professor Jenny Jo and Professor Chung Hyung Kyung, who is a peace counselor since the very beginning, I believe. Is that right, Jim, that she's been?
That's right. She was one of our original peace counselors.
And our global manifesto today, appropriately, is the Earth Charter. So I just wanted to welcome you all. I can see that a few people are still joining on to the call. And I'm thinking that it would be nice if we could begin with a centering prayer or a blessing as we have been doing. And for the risk of putting someone on the spot, I see that one of our new attendees, Reverend Patrick McCollum, is on the call today. And I wondered, Patrick, if you would be willing to do an opening prayer or blessing for us today.
Sure, I'd be happy to do that. I don't know if I have a good connection. I am in a very remote site.
We hear you pretty well.
Okay, well, good. Okay. So, may the great spirit force that which creates all and maintains all be with us as we're on this call. May we all be energized by the things that we learn, and may we find new meanings to things that we thought we understood. And may this lead to our bringing together all of the information and the things that we've come to study and learn in preparation for this conference. Let it all come together and fill our spirits and our bodies and our hearts, so that when we meet in Rome, we'll be brothers and sisters with a common quest and a common desire, and that we'll come to success and fruition in the conference. Many blessings.
Thank you, Patrick. That was just exactly what we were hoping for. Okay, so the next part of our call basically is something we've been doing that's been popular, a type of community building session, because we have the ability on this conference service to break us down into small groups. You think, Megan, the right number of people would be 3 people or so this time? Have you given it a head count?
Yeah, 3 or 4 will work.
Okay. So what we'll do is we'll break you out into your small groups at random. You might be with people that you've talked to in the past. You might be with completely new people. And all you really need to do is introduce yourself by name, and then everybody just take a couple of minutes. You can talk about whatever you like. You can introduce yourself and what you do. You can talk about what brought you to be called to this conference. You can talk about something that you've studied on the tutorial, anything at all that's going on in your life that you'd like to share as you get to know others. And we'll give you some bells every couple of minutes just to keep you on track, but other than that, we won't interrupt and there won't be any facilitation beyond your own facilitation. So as soon as you get the signal, you can begin, and we'll see you all in about 6 or 7 minutes. Okay, have a good time.
You are now in a breakout. Please begin.
Okay, hello again, everyone. I hope that that was enlightening and you got to know some new people and other people better. So let's proceed with the tutorial now. I'm going to let Jim take over and talk about the tradition that we're looking at today, indigenous traditions, basically, which is different in dynamic and structure than a lot of the religions we've looked at before. So, Jim, go ahead.
First of all, what we put together in our resources, where we have a little bit on each one of the religions, if you're just joining us or if you've been around, you'll know that we have a brief description of each of the religions, and then for each one we list something about it that is really excellent. This draws from the thought of the great scholar of religions, the Swiss Fritjof Schuon, who wrote way back in 1976 in a book called The Transcendent Unity of Religions. He wrote that every religion, or to the effect that every religion is superior to every other by virtue of something it does best. So we try to pick some excellence for a tradition. The master stories, what are the great stories? What shapes do they tend to take? What are the most important of the ritual patterns in the religion, and how could we single out a particular ethical norm? We don't always go through these, but I think it's useful with the indigenous traditions. And our brief description runs like this. The religious and spiritual practices of native peoples, all too often dismissed as primitive, in quotations, have shaped the lives of the vast majority of the planet's past and present inhabitants. While these traditions offer an astonishing variety of beliefs and expressions, most share an abiding concern with the natural world and with the spirits that choreograph its movement and hint at its deeper significance. The native traditions acknowledge the confluence of the invisible world with the visible and celebrate the sacredness of all life. Particularly want to call attention to the sort of interweave of the invisible world and the visible world. The great mythologist Joseph Campbell always pointed that out and said that that was the most important of the many wisdoms of indigenous people, that the invisible and the visible are coterminous and contiguous, and it's easy to stumble from one into the other. The excellence that we identified is, we put it this way, an extraordinary tapestry of cultural modes of engagement with the visible world and the invisible world that enfolds it. Master stories in indigenous traditions, and we have to realize that we're not just talking about Native America, we're talking about African traditional religions, the religions of the islands of the South Seas, Latin American, throughout Asia, lots and lots of different indigenous peoples, and each one of their traditions is radically unique, but there are certain things they have in common. And their master stories tend to be origin narratives. Where did we come from? Not only origins of the people, but also of the land, of the spirits, of the fundamental rhythms, and of the principles of life. It's interesting how often in different indigenous traditions, if you ask, what does the name that the people give themselves mean? Whether it's Diné for the people we know as the Navajo, or whatever it happens to be, Inuit, those names most often mean the people. The ritual patterns that we find throughout the world's indigenous traditions almost always have some preoccupation with the celebration of Earth and its creatures. And if there's one ethical norm that you just have to lift up from the indigenous traditions, it is the deep and abiding respect for the community of all life. So I think that's a good introduction. It's worth mentioning that when the field of the scholarship of religion, the study of religion first began, one of its fascinations was the religion of what they termed the primitive people, and the idea that all of the so-called primitive religions were animist. In other words, they believed in spirits that shaped the world. They worshipped spirits. That view has it's still somewhat influential, but it has been tempered quite a bit. And now we often hear that the indigenous traditions believe very strongly, or they celebrate a world that is somehow enspirited, built into the spirit, spirit dwelling in it, enspirited or ensouled. And the last thing I'll say is that when you talk to indigenous people, sooner or later you're going to hear them say, no, ours is not a religion. It's a spiritual path. It's a life path. It's not a religion. And I think partly that has to do with the fact that most indigenous people around the world have encountered other religions, largely Christianity and Islam, and they've encountered them through their missionaries. And they've been left with kind of a bad taste when it comes to organized religion. So I'll end with that.
Do we have any comments or questions at this point? Any impressions that you all took as you were reading about indigenous religions, either on the website or listening to some of the recording today, or just from the knowledge that you happen to have about indigenous traditions in the past and how they differ in a certain way from other kinds of religions that we've been studying. Is there anyone that would like to venture forth a comment? Peggy Carpenter. Go ahead, Peggy.
I was very fortunate to be a part of a festival this last week in which there was a drum ceremony done by a shaman woman, Indian shaman woman. She said the indigenous people were not called a religion because they did not have a temple. Their temple was the earth, and their temple was and their religion was their day-to-day life. I thought that was so encouraging.
Thank you, Peggy. I couldn't have asked for a better way of leading into our discussion of our interview with Professor Jenny Jo, because Jim and I were just discussing before the call began that it struck us so interesting that Native American traditions are so tied to their sense of place. And although it differs among the different groups, that sacred places have different meanings. It has more to do with where they feel rooted from the standpoint of their place in nature rather than any building or mosque or formalized man-made dwelling. And some of the reasons for why they feel that way, which include defining the story of how people came to be where they are, is a very big part of the Native American story. Also, it sometimes the place in nature talks about a story, something where a very important event had taken place, or even where deities that are important to their spiritual practice were thought to have their home. So what you brought up was really important about some of the things that Jenny said in her interview. So, Jim, maybe we should just go right ahead and start talking about that now.
I think that Barbara and I both agreed that the interview with Jenny Jo. Can I just interrupt and say we've learned this week that Jenny will be joining us in Italy. So both of our interviewees this week, Chung Yang Kyung from Korea and Jenny Jo from Arizona and the Navajo Reservation there, they'll both be with us. I think that's really exciting. But
maybe you could say a few words of introduction about Jenny before we talk about her interview.
Sure. Jenny Jo is a professor at the University of Arizona, and she's actually in the medical school, and she teaches about a whole range of health-related issues that concern, in particular, tribal people. And as a matter of fact, one of the concerns she's had is that she's going to be a presenter at the National Institutes of Health meeting, a national meeting that follows our conference, but it just works out just right so she can come. She's also a professor there at the University of Arizona in the Native American Studies Department. She's really a remarkable woman, a first-rate scholar, medical practitioner, and so on, and brings a great deal of insight. It's worth simply mentioning that when you're talking about Navajos, there's one of the real problems that faces the people. By the way, there's another example. Navajo is a name, as is the case with most indigenous people. It's a name given to them by others, and it means the strangers or even the enemies. They call themselves the Diné, and that means, of course, the people. But among the Navajo or the Diné, there's a very, very strong taboo about death, and anyone who comes in contact with a dead body or someone who is dying needs to go through a ceremony of purification, a blessing way ceremony, or it's actually a slightly different one. But so that makes it very difficult for the people to produce medical care professionals. Because a big part of the training of a doctor is the encounter with death, and so this is something the tradition has had to work out. And Jenny plays a very major role in trying to produce native Navajo doctors and nurses. So, but she talks about the symbolism of everyday life, and she begins at a certain point in the interview by talking about the fact that everyone who dwells on the reservation either lives in or has lived in a hogan. And if you've driven through the Navajo reservation there in Arizona and partly in New Mexico, you've seen these rounded buildings. They sort of look like our conception of an igloo, except they're made of sticks and branches and grass and soil and so on. And it's a very humble dwelling, but it actually serves as a sacred center, and ceremonial activities take place, and the deities are summoned to help someone who is in need. When someone dies in a hogan, a hole is broken in the back to allow all the spirits to escape, and it's not ever used again as a dwelling. But the hogan itself, in its construction, I just think this is so fascinating as she spoke about it. The construction of the building, this little hut actually, reflects the four sacred mountains that are so important. And this goes back to what Barbara was saying about the importance of land and nature and specific place. Spirituality is something that is tied for most indigenous people to a particular place. Missionary work by indigenous people is unheard of, essentially, because you don't try to take the message of the place to some other place. Well, the construction of the hogan reflects the four sacred mountains that are the boundaries, if you will, of the sacred space that was the reservation that was given to the Navajo to care for and to make their life meaningful. She also spoke about something that's been a favorite of mine for a long time, and I bet lots and lots of you on the call are aware of this, that the benediction line of most prayer of the Diné people goes something like this. It acknowledges that there is beauty before you, or may there be beauty before you, beauty behind you, beauty below you, and beauty above you. And she says that's what the pathway of spirituality and nature, that's what that pathway symbolizes. And just briefly, let me say she also talked about the problem of displacement. And this brings back this whole business of the missionaries. When children were taken from the reservations and taken from their homes and taken to schools where they were punished, and this is true all throughout Native America, Christian missionaries would take them to their schools and punish them terribly for speaking their native languages or for practicing any of their native rituals. They were to be Christians, and they were to forget all that other stuff. And so that's a kind of displacement, moving people to reservations that are far away from their original sacred places. And then she talked about a different kind of displacement, a more gradual displacement, in the place of poverty on the reservation and in traditional lands. Young people are simply forced to move away, to move to the next largest city or even out of state to find jobs and support their families. So they disconnect themselves from their homeland and from their early childhood. So this is a real problem. The connection to the land is the keystone, the touchstone of the spirituality. And she did speak a little bit about efforts to rekindle that spirituality and that connection to the land. And it's a major challenge. And we hear this from indigenous people all over the world, in the islands, in Africa, what people call ATR, African Traditional Religion, this whole business of displacement and loss of intimate contact with the land is probably the number one issue. It's a very serious one. It's worth mentioning in closing that for the first time, this has been going on now for about 10 years, and in part I will say it did grow out of the 1993 and 1999 Parliaments of the World's Religions, or they helped to influence it. That is the creation of a couple of global associations of indigenous people so that they can come together, meet, learn about each other's traditions, and above all, learn about the challenges that they all face and perhaps face them together and develop a little bit of political influence and muscle. It's a very important thing that's happening.
Yeah, I agree. We'll wrap this up and move on to the next interview, but I was struck by a couple of things very briefly. One is the emphasis that Jenny pointed out the Native Americans placed on spirituality in relationship to healing, that not unlike other spiritual traditions that we've talked about and many of us practice, there is a deep respect for the power of prayer and the spirituality that actually directly heals the human being and does so on not just the physical level, but uses the whole human as a basis for the healing process. And I thought that was very worth mentioning. And I also wanted to say a word about the idea of the not losing, how sad and difficult it is to think about the young people coming from traditions that have been in one way or another displaced, that have migrated, that are seemingly dispossessed from their place, because over time they've not only lost their home, they begin to lose their culture. Part of it is in the positive sense to assimilate, but then a lot of it is that in order to not be discriminated against as the other, quote-unquote, there's a lot of pressure to somehow be absorbed into other cultural forms, other religious traditions. And Jenny pointed out that now you find Native Americans belonging to every faith. And that's perfectly fine, except that it becomes sad when the young people start to lose a sense of worth or respect for their indigenous tradition.
That's really true.
So let's go on, just in the interest of time, and talk about Professor Kyung Kyung's interview, because that was absolutely dynamic. So maybe, Jim, you could talk a little bit about her to begin.
Okay. Her last name is Chung, Professor Chung. She's at Union Theological Seminary. She also spends part of the year at Ewha Women's University in Seoul. She's a native of Seoul, Korea. And she is a fascinating person. She's a practicing Buddhist. She's also an ordained Presbyterian minister. So she brings a really unique perspective to things.
A walking interfaith movement.
She is a walking interfaith movement, and so much more. She calls herself the bandit queen of ecofeminism. So you're in for a treat when you meet Professor Chung. But her first name, which often comes last, usually she's listed as Chung Young Kyung. Her first name is hyphenated, H-Y-U-N hyphen K-Y-U-N-G, and it's just pronounced Young Kyung. Young Kyung. And she's a delightful, beautiful person. You'll absolutely love her. She is off to Korea now. She'll be returning to Union at the end of January, but she'll be joining us. But before she joins us, she's taking a month-long Vipassana meditation retreat in Burma. So this is a person of deep spirituality and so on. She'll also, she loves at these conferences to lead voluntary morning meditations. And if you have a chance to catch one of them, you'll want to do that. She's dynamite. She talks about ecofeminism. And I just want to mention that the first time I heard that term used was at the 1993 Parliament of the World's Religions. And it was Susanna Heschel, a professor of religious studies from Dartmouth College, and who is the daughter of Abraham Joshua Heschel, the late Abraham Joshua Heschel, certainly the most influential rabbi of our age, I think, was involved in the March on Selma and a close colleague of Martin Luther King. Anyway, she is his daughter, and she's an activist in her own right. Susanna is, and she said, in a presentation about Sacred Earth, she said, it's no accident that we refer to it as Mother Earth. We call her Mother Earth, and we proceed to treat her exactly as we have always treated women. And that got a few chuckles from the group, but people gradually realized that she was in absolute earnest, and she went on to make it clear just how important that connection was. Well, Young Kyung tells us that the term ecofeminism was invented by a French feminist philosopher, Françoise de Beaune, in 1976, and she said that the oppression of women and the oppression of nature are directly connected in our patriarchal philosophical system. And she goes on to, in her interview, she went on to say that from the time of Plato and Aristotle, the idea was always around that men were most closely connected with the spiritual world, or the world of ideas, and women much more closely connected with the earthly, or the material world. This is dualistic thinking. Obviously, it's hierarchical thinking. It's very patriarchal, and we're moving away from it. But she says, so women in the earth were considered for a long, long time, this is a quote from her, the soulless, spiritless matter, simply material, whereas men were considered spirit-filled culture makers. She said, so when I began to learn the church's history and dogmatics, I was so shocked that the church fathers had a serious theological discussion that lasted for 300 years about whether or not women have a soul. She says, today we laugh about it, but scientists are saying the same thing now about, or asking the same thing about, whether animals have souls. And she says, of course they do. If you have dogs and cats and birds that you raise, you know they're soulful beings. And she says, all the indigenous people I know, or all the indigenous people know that rivers have souls and trees are souled. And I think this kind of dualistic thinking and hierarchical thinking has been the basis, she says, of sexism and capitalism and the destruction of this precious earth. So ecofeminists and activists worldwide are trying to correct this wrong view of women and earth. We imagine women and earth as spirit, soul-filled subjects of this universe and this ongoing creation. So this is, I think it's a powerful message, and I think it's one that is going to resound throughout our conversations in Italy.
One of the things that I was really appreciating about the content of this interview is that she actually embodies such a good case for the purpose of the way that our conference is structured, that she somehow finds a way to integrate all of the topics that are under discussion. We're definitely looking at the earth. We're looking at the social institutions that define our society. We're looking at our sacred tradition and how we mutually influence one another. We're looking at the things where the work we still have to do in terms of reconciling with the other. And when she speaks about these, she so seamlessly seems to be able to integrate the interdependence of all these issues, which I think is absolutely brilliant. And we should be learning how to have that conversation, I think, much more often. Hopefully we'll be practicing that in Rome and Florence together.
Absolutely.
You know, another thing that I liked about this interview, and I don't know how many of you have been following what's going on with the women religious in the United States and the Vatican, but I suspect that many of you do know quite a bit about this discussion, and others of you are intimately involved in it at this time. But what Hyung Kyung had impressed upon me in the interview was, let me see if I can find it here, that if there's not a serious change in the idea of this power over mode of doing religious work and the exclusion of women from leadership positions in religion, that the next generation of women will stop fighting against the system and simply leave it and practice their own spirituality, taking whatever resources they can from their own ancient religious tradition, and they'll not pay any attention to the outdated patriarchal religious systems. I think that's prophetic in a way, because in many ways I think it's already happening. Luckily, and I think lovingly, the way that I see it happening with the religious women in the Vatican is that they're proposing a dialogue in the most non-contentious way. Jim, do you have some ideas about why that's taking place right now?
Well, I think one reason, one of the people that we're going to have at the conference that you will meet, and I promise you, if you haven't already met her, you'll never forget her, is Sister Joan Chittister, who once said to me that, only half in jest, that there is a whole secretariat at the Vatican that is charged with seeing what she's up to. And she laughed, but you can be sure that there's a little truth to that. And I remember asking her, we were in Chiapas, Mexico, and Gonzalo, you were there in the room, and perhaps you remember Father Gonzalo Ituarte. And I said something to her like, why are you still involved? All of the pressure and so on, why don't you step outside the church and continue the work you're doing? And she said, honey, it's over. The boys in Rome don't know that it's over, but it's over.
And when was she said that?
This was in 1995.
Well,
or 1996. And she's still very much involved in the struggle, but believes that it's important that the struggle be carried on by people outside the religious establishments, but also people within those religious establishments, and that's going to make the difference. And also, she's a big one, and I think some of the leaders of this struggle with the Vatican and the current effort to repress the voices of women religious in the United States, that somehow two wrongs don't make a right, and you just keep holding out for dialogue, and eventually that will prevail. And I think they have momentum. I think they have the moral high ground. And I guess I'm hopeful enough to believe that not only have they chosen the right path, but the one that's likely to be successful.
Yeah, well, I think that the important takeaway here is that the idea of the feminine model for leadership, it doesn't have much to do with one type of biology over another. It has to do with a mindset that is very different. It completely deviates from the domination model, the winner take all model that's shaped our economics and so many of other social institutions, but tends to be exclusive, doesn't necessarily pose the polarity of winner and loser or strong and weak and so on. And that this idea that if the feminine model, not necessarily the woman herself, but if the feminine model of leadership and governance can actually prevail, some kind of sanity in that way could prevail, that many of the challenges that we're facing would include the needs of most of the people rather than eliminating the needs of 49% of them at any given time. So,
well, I'm reminded of Rhianne Eisler, who, of course, wrote The Chalice and The Blade and so on, and she's always drawing the contrast between the dominator model and the partnership model. And she always stresses that egalitarian partnership approach is much more prevalent in the indigenous traditions. And Barbara Marx Hubbard uses a lot of that same language, the dominator versus the partner model.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that it very much ties in with our whole discussion about ecofeminism, because we're bringing it back to where we began, this idea of the relationship between the feminine and the earth, and both the positive resources and the negative treatment that maybe they've both received, that these are very productive clues that can be taken as we move forward. Mm-hmm. I would think at this point that this is a juicy enough discussion that we might have some comments or questions from the people on the call before we move to our final section about the Earth Charter. So I wonder if I could now ask you, who are on the call, to engage with us a little bit in this dialogue and just offer some ideas or opinions about some of the ideas that we've been floating. A man named Stephen Pope has raised his hand. Go ahead, Stephen.
I just had a question. Hello, and thank you for this incredible offering of information and inspiration. But I wanted to go back to something Jim said very early on, and it was also on the webpage, that somehow the indigenous nature-oriented religions of the whole world have all this in common. And I just wanted to find out, is there an easy way to somehow build a taxonomy of how North American indigenous religion is different from something in Papua New Guinea or Africa? It's just, it seems shocking to me that one would lump them together and say they're all common. Or is that fair, or is it really?
Well, to
where would you differentiate them, Jim?
Hi, Stephen. First of all, I'm gonna really resist the term lumping. I agree, you can't lump them together. And you certainly can't say they're all the same. And we began by saying that they weren't. They're very, very different in their ritual and their practice and so on. But I'd back into it a different way. Try to find an indigenous tradition anywhere in the world that does not at least begin with the presumption of the sacredness of the earth and the sacredness of their immediate environment, and the notion that somehow the spirit world informs the physical world around them, earth, air, fire, and water, the trees, the mountains, and so on. And that is, although I know you know this, but that is going to translate into forms that would be mutually incomprehensible. So the Papuan is not going to look at the Navajo and say, oh, yeah, we have that. But the student of religion or the student of spirituality can say there is at least this. They grow out of that same fundamental, most basic spiritual intuition that there is no line that separates the sacred from the profane.
Nice. Anybody else that wants to make a comment before we move on? Patrick McCollum, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment. I've done quite a bit of work with indigenous peoples in the South Pacific, in the Himalayas, and with the Native Americans. And I've taken people from some of those different groups with me on trips to the others. And one of the things that I noticed that was very unique is that they seem to very rapidly bond and feel comfortable with one another quite differently than a lot of the more organized religions do when they come together. And I think there's a lot to be learned from them in that aspect. As Jim pointed out, there's very distinct differences. But this commonality with the earth and the connection of that we're all interconnected in one way or the other creates like a common fertile ground that makes everybody sort of feel like you're in a comfortable place. And when I was doing that, it made me feel a lot like, you know, if you go to a city that you lived in your whole life, you feel very at home there. And so the things there feel normal to you. And you go somewhere far away and they feel different to you. And people in a lot of the mainstream faiths go to a different faith group or something and they feel uncomfortable because it doesn't feel like home. But these people are home everywhere they go, even though they have place. So anyway, that was just a comment I wanted to make.
And I just want to say, Patrick, that is so insightful and so right. I couldn't agree more. And we had an experience with the 99 Parliament in Cape Town. We brought, at the 93 Parliament, we were able to bring together 37 elders from 25 nations in North America, North and South America, and that was unprecedented. But we tried to do the same thing as we went to Cape Town. And another Navajo woman, who's the one that introduced me to Jenny many years ago, Omi Baldwin, who's a teacher at the University of Wisconsin at Madison, helped put together that group. Well, once again, we had about 25 people who were elders and deeply experienced people from nations all over North and South America, primarily North. And they were so anxious to meet African traditional people, and the African traditionalists were just as anxious. And it's exactly as Patrick describes. It's as though, I mean, we introduced them to each other, and that was all. There, we didn't have to be brokers. There were some language barriers, but talk about immediate understanding and bonding. And at the end of two or three days, they were talking about commonalities in their practice and their dance and so on. You may be aware that shamanic cultures tend either to be drumming cultures or rattling cultures, and this is something that fascinated them, because some of them were drummers and some were rattlers, but they had that same polarity. But they ended up talking about the common threats to their spiritual traditions, and they were identical. Things like displacement, things like missionary activity, and so on. So, Patrick, I think you really hit the nail on the head.
One more quick comment from Jeanette Baust. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi, Barbara. I had two thoughts, actually. One is that feminism, when I first was acquainted with it back in the 70s, was really beginning to be big in identity politics.
Mm-hmm.
And that was beginning to pulled groups very much apart. Sometimes womanist, feminist, white feminist, mujerista were juxtapositioned against their male counterparts in the academy, and all that kind of thing was going on. And the other thing that was happening was feminists were very often, because of patriarchy in traditional religion, really removing themselves from religion. So they were increasingly moving towards secular humanism, and if not that, then something that was much more Gaia-oriented or only feminine-oriented. But that also left a gap, because they were tending to move from one side completely to another side. And then the term emerged, and I think it's interesting how this happens, that people saw that there was so much fracturing taking place that the term emerged called intersectionality.
Mm-hmm.
And people started saying, you know, we're different. But yet there are these intersections, and those moments of intersection bring insight and real joy and real connection, and that has always been very helpful to me, even in terms of faith traditions, that there's some traditions that seem so unlike where I am right now that I can't really align them completely and say, oh, see how these really just match up? But still, when the intersections happen, it's really a wonderful transforming moment. And so that's the one piece. I just wanted to make one other comment about Chittister's line, because sometimes, especially if you do any politics, and Barbara, you know, I do a fair amount of that, it just can feel like some days you're pushing a truck up a hill with a string. And it was John Spong who once said he knew that when 5% of evangelicals had accepted the notion that homosexuality was not abnormal or aberrant, but maybe a blessing from God, that it was over.
Right.
You know, and some of us were saying, really? But that reminded me of that quote that says, first they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they get angry at you, and then you've won. And I think that Joan Chittister has gone through a lot of that with the Vatican and with nuns and with other religious, saying, first we were totally ignored, and, you know, then people laughed at us and said, oh, how silly, and then they started getting really ticked. And you know what, and it doesn't always feel like that in the moment, but people who, I think, take the long view of history and have watched this happen one thing after another, even watching the Democratic National Committee right now, finally including gays in their platform, it's like, how long did that take? And I know that, you know, the other side's looking at it going, uh-oh, we're going to have to make a decision here. And I think back to Spong when it was only 5%, and he said, okay, we've won. So
yeah.
Those are two
ideas. Oh, thanks, Jeanette. That's great, really.
Yeah.
I've got one more comment here from Reverend Michael. If you can be kind of brief with that, because I'd like Jim to have a little time to talk about Earth Charter before you all have to sign off the call. You want to go ahead, Michael?
Certainly. Thank you. I just wanted to comment that from my perspective, one of the commonalities in all traditions is the awareness of the spirit that's infused in, this awe-inspiring presence that's in what we may call spirit, even though we call it by, different names. And so in any of the traditions, when we hear the drums or the rattles or the practice of the remembrance from the Sufis, whatever it is, we feel that that resonance, something deep within us stirring. I think in the sacred and the profane, he refers to it as the numinous, that element of awe. And then I was just going to mention that, in the scientific field of DNA research, I would invite everyone to just go get the swab. Once we get the swab, we take a look at our DNA, the Y DNA and the mitochondrial, and we see how it's interwoven and where we all came from. We realize then that we all came from the same place, and that's where we're headed. So, I do see us all being lumped together, as it were, because we are together. So that was my comment.
Thank you, Michael. Be prepared to be lumped. Okay, well, on a very different note, we don't want to leave the call without mentioning a little bit about this very important global manifesto, the Earth Charter. And I do remember when that was first being crafted. Was it 1992 and 3, Jim, when we were working on the Parliament in Chicago? Why don't you give us an overview of that, because it's such an important document.
Well, the inspiration came out of the Earth Summit at Rio in 1992, and it was generally agreed that there needed to be some kind of document of this sort, or some kind of testament, if you will, what is it we're working on and working for. But there was general feeling that maybe the time wasn't right, the political time wasn't right. But a couple of people picked up on it, and it's worth mentioning them. One, of course, is Maurice Strong, and Barbara, Maurice Strong, and he was chair of the Earth Summit at Rio, and he went on to start the Earth Council. And another major player that often surprises people is Mikhail Gorbachev. And he, after he left the presidency of the disintegrating Soviet Union, he decided that he wanted to get involved in a grander cause. And he chose ecological sustainability. And he formed an organization that's still around and still very influential called Green Cross. And Maurice and Mikhail Gorbachev tried to get this idea of an Earth Charter on some kind of healthy footing. And they brought in a third partner. And this is an amazing guy that I know a bit. And this is Stephen Rockefeller. And he's professor emeritus of religion and actually of Buddhist studies at Middlebury College. But he's also one of the Rockefeller brothers and is a trustee of the Rockefeller Brothers Fund. And he became the chair of the Earth Charter International Drafting Committee. And I'll just tell you that of all of these documents, this one has a kind of unique aspect, and that is that it went through so many iterations. They formed Earth Charter committees and study groups in virtually every university campus you can imagine, cities all over the world. The whole process of circulating drafts, and people would not like this part and they'd like this part, and the whole thing, they kept processing and sending out again and processing and sending out again, until finally there was broad general agreement on four pillars, which I'll tell you quickly what they are, although we have them on the website, and 16 principles. And there are four principles under each of the four pillars. And the pillars are respect and care for the community of life, ecological integrity, social and economic justice, and democracy, nonviolence, and peace. And it is, I think it's an extraordinary document. Then there are the 16 pillars, the 16 points, I mean, principles that are under the four pillars, and each one of those principles breaks out into a number of practical ideas and things that are worth working for. And you can find the whole document. It's a fairly compact document. There's a nice link to it on the conference website. And I just think I so admire the patience of the drafting and wanting to hear from everyone that cared to go to a local meeting. Maybe you were at the University of Miami in Ohio and you joined an Earth Charter group and went to meeting after meeting and learned and put in your 2 cents worth, and somehow it was all brought together. There were flaws and there were complaints, but I think it's a remarkable document. It's easy to read, easy to sort of ingest and digest, and once you've taken a good look at it, I think it will change your ideas about what's important and what might be possible in an increasingly ecological age.
Yeah, I think it points out, because, you know, we've studied now seven modules these types of documents, and I think we're now pretty much over the idea that a document is something that's supposed to achieve something once and for all and then you move on. I think that what's important to say about these documents is that it's a perennial uphill climb, and that the importance of the documents, aside from the fact that there has been so much deliberation and research that's gone into them, that we've used the word meme before, M-E-M-E, the idea of actually shaping an entirely different cultural idea that takes hold in a society. And whether or not we've achieved the goals of the Earth Charter really is secondary to the fact that it's this document and others very like it that have inspired the conversation that has changed a meme in the way that society is looking at these questions in the first place. So I'm hoping that in our conference in Rome, we're actually going to be working toward a document charter for engaged spirituality in the 21st century that will, in a similar way, allow deliberations about these very complex issues to continue in a productive way.
When you think about documents like the Earth Charter, the Brundt Report, James Quilligan is on the call again with us, and he spoke with us when we discussed that. He was very much involved in the creation and the ongoing life of that document, Towards a Global Ethic, the document of the Parliament of the World's Religions, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. All of them still are viable. They still have a life. They still influence the way we think, and they have become sources of some of the most important memes that are in circulation today. I'm really glad you introduced that term, Barbara.
I mean, I just didn't make up that word? No.
No, Richard Dawkins made up that word, actually.
I know. So we're 3 minutes after six, and I don't want to keep you all. I just wanted to say thank you for being here, that the next Module 8, which is the second to our last tutorial, takes place on September 20th. This is the spiritual tradition that we're looking at next time is actually the New Thought tradition. There's the video meditations on healing, and we'll be listening to interviews with two more people who will be joining us in Rome, Reverend Dr. Michael Bernard Beckwith and Sister Joan Chittister. The Chiang Mai Declaration will be our global manifesto. So that will be a really, really interesting set of studies. And so I hope that you'll all be joining us again in a couple of weeks. Any last minute comments that anyone wanted to bring in? I see that Father Gonzalo had his hand up and we missed him before. Are you still with us?
I just wanted to mention that being with the indigenous people in Mexico in the south who have been converted to Catholicism in the 16th century, even today the spirit, their approach to reality and to religion, it's alive and gives, enriches the Catholic understanding. So they have survived in spite of the conversion to Catholicism forced, but they keep their spirituality alive with a Christian form. And say that I'm really happy to be able to be with you in these days and in Rome.
Thank you so much.
We're glad you're going to be there, Gonzalo.
I can't wait to meet everybody.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you. We'll see you in a couple of weeks. Thanks, everyone. Good night.
Good night.